And stay tuned for Razor's Edge coming right up.
Hello, welcome to Razor's Edge, local and independent current affairs straight from Sydney, on 2SER 107.3. I'm Daniel Butler. Today on the show...
It was pretty confronting, to be honest, the thing which confronted us the most was the fact that it was places that we frequent quite often.
A student-led investigation at the University of Sydney has uncovered far-right messages shared alongside university material online. It comes with disturbing incidents of discrimination and hate speech on campus. Also on the show today...
It's something that has been hidden for a very long time, and now people are calling for transparency.
The funeral service industry has been shaken by accusations of price gouging and a bullying work environment as the sector grows ever more monopolised. All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. First, it's taken weeks, endless amendments, heated exchanges, and one failed coup, but abortion was today decriminalised in New South Wales.
So, members, in conclusion, I ask that we all finally come together, we can move forward, and we accept the amendments from the upper house, and we acknowledge that now abortion will be decriminalised in New South Wales.
Order, please.
The independent MP for Sydney, Alex Greenwich, presented the bill to Parliament back in August with the support of cross-party MPs. When it was finally passed today, there were hugs, cheers and tears in the chamber as abortion was decriminalised after 119 years. New South Wales is the last state in the country to decriminalise abortion. In practical terms, the move isn't a huge change. Women have received abortions for years in New South Wales. But implicit is a large cultural shift.
What we have with this piece of legislation is that abortion will now be treated as healthcare rather than something in the Crimes Act.
Edwina McDonald is the Sydney Legal Director at the Human Rights Legal Centre. She says the change is about empowerment.
So by decriminalising abortion, we are returning autonomy to women. And women will have the freedom to make choices about their own bodies and their own lives.
A raft of amendments to the bill were proposed, some practical, others an attempt at sabotaging the change in legislation. In the end, several amendments were passed, including more freedom for conscientiously objecting doctors to refuse to perform abortions. Edwina believes the bill was nonetheless worthwhile.
Absolutely. It's absolutely worthwhile. We've decriminalised abortion. We've removed substantial barriers to women accessing reproductive health services, particularly women in rural areas. And it's a long overdue change and one that's very welcome.
The bill and its amendments were unsurprisingly incredibly contentious. Parliament House saw brawling inside and out as protesters from both sides of the debate clashed outside on Macquarie Street. MPs argued over the amendments inside the chambers. It was not a purely partisan affair and proved divisive for the Liberal Party.
I think it's a difficult issue for all Conservative politicians. Abortion's always been an issue which the progressive side of politics has pursued.
Jenna Price is an academic at the University of Technology, Sydney. She believes Gladys Berejiklian's handling of the affair deserves credit.
I think credit to Gladys for standing up for it, to be honest. And I think that she's done a good job of cobbling together a coalition of Conservatives who are happy to support parts of this bill. She was very outspoken herself when she was on the Ben Fordham program a couple of weeks ago. So I think she's looking pretty good. And, of course, you're always going to get a bunch of whining losers to say that this is a disappointment and it was done without appropriate notice. But, I mean, women have been campaigning about abortion for, you know, decades.
Berejiklian Leon faced a very public, if dismally executed, putsch during the course of the debate, and several Conservative MPs expressed their displeasure with the process. But Jenna believes her position as Premier is secure for now.
She won an election handsomely. She's holding the party together despite numerous challenges and dissension around a variety of issues, not just abortion. I can't even imagine who they might replace her with. I mean, anyone more conservative or more progressive would divide the party even more than it's already divided.
The fight to decriminalise is over, but as the national dialogue around a religious discrimination bill rolls on, there are some fears it could undermine and overrule the right to an abortion. Edwina says the Human Rights Law Commission is not letting down its guard.
Look, we're looking at that one closely at the moment, and we'll be putting out our view shortly around that. Certainly, we wouldn't want to see that bill undermining the reproductive health rights of people in New South Wales or elsewhere in Australia.
Edwina McDonald, the Sydney Legal Director at the Human Rights Legal Centre, ending that report.
Spring is here and Sydney Fringe Festival is in full swing. This year, Fringe comes to the CBD as we take over the City Tattersalls Club and the Rocks throughout September, along with an enormous program spread right across Greater Sydney. Immerse yourself in 30 days of theatre, comedy, circus, live music, dance, food and lots more. Celebrate some of the best independent live performance this city has to offer. Book your tickets at sydneyfringe.com today. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Fringe.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Well, the University of Sydney's student publication, Honi Soir, ran an investigation last week which revealed connections between white nationalist posts on a website and the university. Honi Soir editors trawled through 30,000 messages posted on the site, Discord, to find campus material and Honi Soir articles shared alongside racist and anti-Semitic content. At the same time, there have been incidents on campus of students sharing pro-Hitler sentiments in class and racist graffiti found on university buildings. Kate Atkinson asked Jessica, one of Honi Soir's editors, about what it was like to see university content shared alongside white nationalist rhetoric.
It was pretty confronting, to be honest. Just, I think, the thing which confronted us the most was the fact that it was places that we frequent quite often and that these things may be going on covertly without us even realising. But beyond that, I don't think it was so surprising that there are people on campus who harbour these sorts of views, because there has been a sort of surge of right-wing action, I suppose, on campus for the past 2 or 3 years.
Right, and is there evidence that the same people who were posting on Discord were the same ones involved in sharing that, Nazi imagery and hate speech on campus?
Yeah, so that Discord was disabled at the beginning of this year when the American collective Unicorn Riot found it. But we can say that in 2017, there were definitely people who were a part of the Young Liberals at UCID who also had links to neo-Nazi groups. And so pictures of those young liberals were found on the Discord at that time.
And what kinds of messages and posts were you seeing spread by Sydney-based users who might have had links to UCID?
Sure. So it was a lot of sort of xenophobic comments relating to, Chinese people running in elections here at the university. And just generalised racism was a lot of it, and some sexist stuff too.
And how far-reaching do you think this is? Is it just a few students or is it more widespread?
I don't think we can really say. At this point, we know it's certainly at least a few students. I'm not sure whether they're active now, but at that time, they definitely were. There are a lot of pushes for right-wing interventions into student politics at the moment. So you can't really say how far it does reach. All we know is that there was reach at that time and potentially there is now that we're not aware of.
Okay, and what was the most alarming revelation in the investigation for you?
I think we were just expecting some generalised stuff relating to Sydney, but I think the fact that there was connections to the University of Sydney, specifically people that we know and institutions that we inhabit, because, you know, student unions are supposed to be a left-wing space, and the fact that there's people not only from conservative backgrounds, but actual neo-Nazi backgrounds are trying to infiltrate the space, that's quite confronting for us.
And do you think this will have any effect on student politics? And are you thinking about it today, especially on the day of your student elections?
I think a lot of people have mobilised around the findings. For example, there was a protest on Monday generally by the Autonomous Collective Against Racism against sort of fascism on campus. And I think a lot of people are energised against right-wing mobilising on campus today. Yeah.
Cool. And so you don't think any of that ideology or rhetoric will, impact student politics from now on?
I think it's made an impact on the left, I think, yeah.
Sorry, like their influence isn't growing any stronger?
I don't think at the moment, no, but I think that any sort of right-wing grouping on campus, there's probably something below that facade, yeah.
And how did the university itself respond to your investigation, or did they respond at all?
Not at all, no.
Did you expect them to?
No, not really. I guess it was mostly just campus groups responding as opposed to the university releasing any sort of statement. But it is disappointing that they're not willing to sort of, I guess, like send an email out, even doing like the bare minimum of reaffirming that, you know, campus should be a safe place for students.
Mm-hmm. And will you be taking this investigation any further?
We would like to. I think if we receive any leads or anything of that sort, for sure.
Jessica, one of University of Sydney's Honi Soir editors, ending that report by Kate Atkinson.
Now in its final 2 weeks, the Sydney Fringe Festival has something for everyone. Come and check out the best of our independent artists across the city with over 150 shows and events to fill your calendar. Dance all night with us on Saturday, September 28th at the official closing party in this giant immersive theatre dance party taking you back through the decades. Visit sydneyfringe.com today for all the info. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Fringe.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney, on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, of which sovereignty was never ceded. The funeral industry is in disarray after both workers and clients allege price gouging, customer shaming and an archaic work environment. One company in particular, Invacare, has been accused of pushing for a monopolisation of the industry, acquiring almost 300 businesses within the last 5 years. While the large companies have rejected these claims, some operators within the sector are calling for further regulation. Eva Blakemore has this report.
Shocking allegations have come out about the funeral industry, including the monopolisation of business, price gouging and shaming vulnerable customers into spending more. Invocare is at the centre of these claims, an ASX-listed company that owns almost 300 funeral homes around Australia, including Simplicity and White Lady Funerals. Kerry Mills is an ex-funeral home worker and says she remembers the industry as being restrictive, archaic and uncompassionate.
Compared to what I'm able to do for myself, planning memorials and that sort of thing, I found it really restrictive. And I do think that there was a lack of compassion for the families.
Greg Inglis is one of the victims of that lack of compassion. After losing his mother to pancreatic cancer, he and his father arranged her funeral with Invocare-owned Newtown operator WN Bull.
I don't remember too much of it because Dad was doing most of the organising, but he said that he was rushed into having a funeral service 4 days after Mum died. It was in the hospice's chapel. We only had 45 minutes because there was another funeral after Mum. Couldn't fit everyone inside the chapel and we made the most of it, but really, it wasn't a great celebration of who Mum was.
Kerry says that rushed services are a common problem, a problem that seemed to be unique to Australia.
And when you look at Australia, funerals happen so quickly here compared to other countries in the world. You go to the UK, it can be 2 to 3 weeks, and that's nothing for it to be two and a half, 3 weeks between somebody dying and them having a funeral. And that's just become the culture. That's what the expectation is here.
Cheryl Forbes is one half of Inner West Independent Funeral Directors, which is contracted by funeral network Picaluna. She says that the lack of transparency is a huge hidden issue in the industry.
There are some operators that have some practices that are quite questionable. It's something that has been hidden for a very long time, and now people are calling for transparency and saying we want to know what this cost is, what that cost is.
Greg's father unfortunately fell victim to that and was forced to pay over $10,000 for his wife's service.
But it was very expensive back then. He seems to think it was close to $10,000, so they absolutely robbed him blind. It was just every step of the way he was rushed into it.
Many operators are able to coerce grieving families into paying more for their loved one's service by shaming them into buying what they call the best of the best.
You know, it's sort of like, look, your mum was a humble lady from what you told me, but she definitely wasn't cheap. And you really owe it to her to look at this white Richmond here because it really speaks volumes to who she was. You know, they'll use tactics like that.
Kerry says that one of the problems is that small business can no longer compete with the large companies like InvoCare, who cut their prices down to win clients but don't deliver on service.
For some of the really big companies that own many funeral parlours, they can do a cost funeral, like a low-cost funeral, so much cheaper than the local independents can. And it's a real shame because the independents really do provide a really lovely service in their community.
The funeral industry doesn't have a specific regulatory body, so these issues like price gauging and customer shaming are left without consequence, apart from the effect on clients' bank accounts. The industry was called to heel in the late 80s when the government introduced a regulation that stated funeral homes must itemise disbursement costs in their bills. However, operators are still able to charge out a service fee, and unlike other professions, they don't have to disclose what their fee entails.
So you might have a funeral services fee in your bill for $7,500, and if you're a lawyer or an accountant, you would have to break that down into billable hours and what the tasks were that were incorporated into that fee. The funeral director doesn't have to do that. So they can just say, that's just for our fee. That's just for our services.
Cheryl says this is largely indicative of big funeral businesses' habits of organising funerals to fit their own tight schedule rather than catering to the needs of their client.
You know, the large funeral companies, it's just about, okay, here's a job, when can we slot this into our schedule? Whereas we like to encourage people, take your time, there's absolutely no hurry. You know, we don't have to just get this done.
Now that Greg has seen all of the other options within the funeral industry, given the option, he says he would have organised his mother's funeral very differently.
So knowing what I know now about the industry and about things, so we would have had mum cremated and we would have held on to the ashes until we all got over that sort of deep fog of grief, whether that be a couple of weeks or a month or whatever. And then I would have bought 100 tickets at the Royal Randwick on race day, got everyone dressed up to the nines. We would have had champagne, had a laugh, had a cry, told some stories, and then scatter her ashes at the winning post. And that would have been a really authentic way to say goodbye to mum.
But Cheryl maintains that independent operators like herself are recognising the need for genuine people within the industry and are stepping in to provide families with the support they need.
It's more about the compassion and the way that people are dealt with, the way grieving families are dealt with. So our business model isn't about profit. Our focus is actually on the families and the deceased and how they can be given a meaningful send-off.
Independent funeral celebrant Cheryl Forbes, ending the report by Eva Blakemore.
This is Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3.
Well, experts are calling for the government to put a greater focus on public transport investments over new roads as Sydney's population heads towards 7 million. At a population summit on Monday, speakers raised the critical need for governments to respond to population growth with adequate infrastructure investment or else risk damage to the city's quality of life. Talia Kreft spoke with Stuart Prince, National Executive Officer at the Rail, Train and Bus Union.
What do you make of Anthony Albanese's comments at the Population Summit on Monday night that we need to see greater investment in public transport over cars in Sydney?
When people talk about population growth in Sydney, the first question they ask is, where is everyone going to go? But the second question, which is equally important, is how are people going to move around the city? And we've seen over the past 5 or 6 decades or even longer that governments have prioritised investment in road and in private transport to get people around. But it's got to the point where that's really no longer tenable because there are only so many roads, so many cars that you can fit on the roads. And we need to look at more efficient methods of getting people around the confines of the city. And that's where public transport and in particular mass transit options such as heavy rail come into the picture, and we really need to see a step change in the amounts of investment from both state and federal governments into heavy rail services to make sure that we can move more people into and out of the city and around the city in a timely, efficient and safe manner.
Is the Berejiklian government investing in enough public transport projects?
We've seen investment in new rail lines and in light rail services, particularly in the inner city. But this is really just playing catch up to where we should be. We're investing services to make sure that, you know, the people that we have in the city now can actually get around. And at the same time, the services that we've got are already overcrowded. So we're starting from behind the eight ball, really. And we need considerably more investment to get us not only up to the, you know, meeting current demand, but to get to a position where we're starting to plan for the future. Because as all the projections are showing, Sydney's population growth is going to continue to increase, and we're going to have a lot more people living in Sydney in the future, and we absolutely have to get ahead of the curve so that our transport infrastructure is fit for purpose. One of the things that we've seen from this government is as much as it has invested in some high-profile projects such as the Northwest Metro and the Inner City Light Rail, that too often this government has opted for privatisation as an alternative to actually investing in services. So particularly in the bus sector, rather than investing in more buses and more bus services and extending the reach of buses, the government has simply privatised them as if privatisation is, you know, actually going to fix anything. And that's something that really concerns us, is that we want to see more investment in services and outcomes rather than this privatisation agenda, which doesn't actually improve things for commuters.
Has the state government been largely supportive of toll road projects such as WestConnex in the past due to the income they generate compared with public transport projects?
Yeah, I think the investment in road projects is largely driven by almost a culture within government and the bureaucracy that's what governments do. And it's something that has happened over decades, that these governments think the easiest way to deal with congestion is simply to build more roads. But we know that when you do build these projects, there's this thing called induced demand, which is effectively, if you build it, they will come. So the additional road infrastructure not only spreads the load of the existing number of cars, it actually attracts more people onto the road network and more cars and, you know, more people driving into the city, which then creates further problems and just moves bottlenecks from one part of the network to another. So the way to bust congestion, to use that political phrase, really is to invest in mass transit links, particularly heavy rail, so you can actually get people off the road network and onto a efficient, reliable and safe alternative. And that alternative is public transport, because you can move a lot more people on a train than you can in a car.
Do you think an inadequate public transport network could have impacts on people's quality of life, and it could become a health issue in Sydney in the future?
Absolutely. The great thing about public transport is that everyone can use it. And when you're talking about private transport, not everyone can drive. You know, obviously, kids can't drive. People who have mobility disadvantages may not be able to drive. The elderly can't drive. So there, you need to have transport alternatives for those people who find private transport difficult or impossible. And if you don't have effective public transport to move people around and to get them to where they need to be effectively and in a timely manner, then that is a real disadvantage to those people and adds to social isolation. It prevents people from accessing employment opportunities, and it affects people's quality of life. So that's another reason why we really need to see a focus on public transport investment. We need to make sure that people in parts of Sydney that have social and economic disadvantages are well serviced by public transport, and particularly buses, because those local bus services are really important for people who don't access cars but need to.
How does Sydney's use of public transport compare to other cities in Australia and the world? Has Sydney traditionally been a car-dependent city?
Sydney has a relatively high use of public transport compared to other Australian cities. But on a global scale, it's still well behind some cities that have more of a public transport culture and other cities that are more compact. Because Sydney is geographically spread out over a large area, that has encouraged be reliant on cars. And the further you get out from the CBD, the more likely you are to rely on a car to get around. So that's why we need to make sure that people have access to services, and particularly those local bus services, and to have bus services that then feed into efficient heavy rail services or those mass transit services that allow them to get into the city. So there's an important role for government, firstly in investing in the services, but also ensuring that the planning is done to make sure services are in place for those growth areas where people are sort of moving in out in the city fringe, to make sure that they have options other than the car.
Stuart Prince there, National Executive Officer at the Rail, Train and Bus Union, speaking to Talia Kreft. Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Catch us again next week on Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. I'm Daniel Butler. Till next time.
2SC.